walked slowly up the length of the hall, nodding and smiling to faces on either side. Looking across the hall, I could see another archway near where his chair was placed. Clearly, he could have entered the hall by that doorway instead of the one at the far end of the room. So it was deliberate, this flaunting of his twisted legs and ungainly waddle on the long progress to his seat. Deliberate, too, the contrast with his tall, straight-bodied younger brother, who looked neither to left nor right, but walked straight behind Colm to the wooden chair and took up his station standing close behind. Colm sat and waited for a moment, then raised one hand. The pipe's wailing died away in a pitiful whine, and hall began. It quickly became apparent that this was the regular occasion on which the Laird of Castle Leoch dispensed justice to his taxmen and tenants, hearing cases and settling disputes. There was an agenda. The balding scribe read out the names, and the various parties came forward in their turn. While some cases were presented in English, most of the proceedings were held in Gaelic. I had already noticed that the language involved considerable eye-rolling and foot-stamping for emphasis, making it difficult to judge the seriousness of a case by the demeanour of the participants. Just as I had decided that one man, a rather moth-eaten specimen with an enormous sporran made of an entire badger, was accusing his neighbour of nothing less than murder, arson, and wife-stealing, Colm raised his eyebrows and said something quick in Gaelic that had both complainant and defendant clutching their sides with laughter. Wiping his eyes, the complainant nodded at last, and offered a hand to his opponent as the scribe scribbled busily, quills scratching like a mouse's feet. I was fifth on the agenda, a placement I thought carefully calculated to indicate to the assembled crowd the importance of my presence in the castle. For my benefit, English was spoken during my presentation. "Mistress Beecham, will you stand forth?" called the scribe. Urged forward by an unnecessary shove from Mrs. Fitzgibbon's meaty hand, I stumbled out into the clear space before Colm, and rather awkwardly curtsied, as I had seen other females do. The shoes I had been given did not distinguish between right foot and left, being in either case only an oblong of formed leather, which made graceful manoeuvring difficult. There was a stir of interest through the crowd as Colm paid me the honour of getting up from his chair. He offered me his hand, which I took in order not to fall flat on my face. Rising from the curtsy, mentally cursing my slippers, I found myself staring at Dougal's chest. As my captor, it was apparently up to him to make formal application for my reception, or captivity, depending how you wanted to look at it. I waited with some interest to see just how the brothers had decided to explain me.
"Sir," began Dougal, bowing formally to Colm, "we pray your indulgence and mercy with regard to a lady in need of succour and safe refuge. Mistress Clare Beecham, an English lady of Oxford, finding herself set upon by highwaymen and her servant most traitorously killed, fled into the forests of your lands, where she was discovered and rescued by myself and my men. We beg that Castle Leoch might offer this lady refuge until..."
He paused, and a cynical smile twisted his mouth.
"Her English connections may be apprised of her whereabouts and due provision made for her safe transport."
I didn't miss the emphasis laid on English, and neither did anyone else in the hall, I was sure. So, I was to be tolerated, but held under suspicion. Had he said French, I would have been considered a friendly, or at worst, neutral intrusion. It might be more difficult than I had expected to get away from the castle. Colm bowed graciously to me, and offered me the unlimited hospitality of his humble hearth, or words to that effect. I curtsied again, with somewhat more success, and retired to the ranks, followed by curious, but more or less friendly stares. Until this point, the cases seemed to have been of interest chiefly to the parties involved. The spectators had chatted quietly among themselves, waiting their turns. My own appearance had been met with an interested murmur of speculation and, I thought, approval. But now there was an excited stir through the hall. A burly man stepped forward into the clear space, dragging a young girl by the hand. She looked about 16, with a pretty, pouting face and long yellow hair tied back with blue ribbon. She stumbled into the space and stood alone, while the man behind her expostulated in Gaelic, waving his arms and occasionally pointing at her in illustration or accusation. Small murmurs ran through the crowd as he talked. Mrs. Fitzgibbons, her bulk resting on a sturdy stool, was craning forward with interest. I leaned forward and whispered in her ear, "What's she done?" The huge dame replied, without moving her lips or taking her eyes from the action, "Her father accuses her of loose behaviour, consorting improperly with young men against his orders," muttered Mistress Fitzgibbons, leaning her bulk backward on the stool. "Her father wishes the Mackenzie to have her punished for disobedience." "Punished? How?" I hissed, as quietly as I could. "Shh!" In the centre, attention now focused on Colum, who was considering the girl and her father. Looking from one to the other, he began to speak. Frowning, he rapped his knuckles sharply on the arm of his chair, and a shiver ran through the crowd. "He's decided," whispered Mrs. Fitzgibbons unnecessarily. What he had decided was also clear. The giant stirred for the first time, unbuckling his leather belt in a leisurely manner. The two guards took the terrified girl by the arms and turned her so that her back was to Colum and her father. She began to cry, but made no appeal. The crowd was watching with the sort of intent excitement that attends public executions and road accidents. Suddenly, a Gaelic voice from the back of the crowd rose audible over the shuffle and murmur. Heads turned to locate the speaker. Mrs. Fitzgibbons craned, even rising on tiptoe to see. I had no idea what had been said, but I thought I recognised that voice, deep but soft, with a spiky way of clipping the final consonants. The crowd parted, and Jamie McTavish came out into the clear space. He inclined his head respectfully to the Mackenzie, then spoke some more. Whatever he said seemed to cause some controversy. Colum, Dougal, the little scribe, and the girl's father all seemed to be getting into the act. "What is it?" I muttered to Mrs. Fitz. My patient was looking much better than when last seen, though still a bit white-faced, I thought. He'd found a clean shirt somewhere. The empty right sleeve had been folded and tucked into the waist of his kilt. Mrs. Fitz was watching the proceedings with great interest. "The lad's offering to take the girl's punishment for her," she said absently, peeking around a spectator in front of us. "What? But he's injured! Surely they won't let him do something like that." I spoke as quietly as I could under the hum of the crowd. Mrs. Fitz shook her head. "I dunno, lass. They're arguing it now. See, 'tis allowable for a man of her own clan to offer for her, but the lad is no a Mackenzie."
"He's not?"
I was surprised, having naively assumed that all the men in the group that had captured me came from Castle Leoch.
"Of course not," said Mrs. Fitz impatiently. "Do you know see his tartan?"
Of course I did, once she had pointed it out. While Jamie also wore a hunting tartan in shades of green and brown, the colours were different than that of the other men present. It was a deeper brown, almost a bark colour, with a faint blue stripe. Apparently Dougal's contribution was the deciding argument. The knot of advisers dispersed, and the crowd hushed, falling back to wait. The two guards released the girl, who ran back into the crowd, and Jamie stepped forward to take her place between them. I watched in horror as they moved to take his arms, but he spoke in Gaelic to the man with the strap, and the two guards fell back. Amazingly, a wide, impudent grin lighted his face briefly. Stranger still, there was a quick answering smile on the face of the giant.
"What did he say?"
I demanded of my interpreter.
"He chooses fists rather than the strap.
A man may choose so."
though a woman may not.
Fists!
I had no time to question further. The executioner drew back a fist like a ham and drove it into Jamie's abdomen, doubling him up and driving his breath out with a gasp. The man waited for him to straighten up before moving in and administering a series of sharp jabs to the ribs and arms.
Jamie made no effort to defend himself, merely shifting his balance to remain upright in the face of the assault.
The next blow was to the face. I winced and shut my eyes involuntarily as Jamie's head rocked back. The executioner took his time between blows, careful not to knock his victim down or strike too many times in one spot. It was a scientific beating, skillfully engineered to inflict bruising pain, but not to disable or maim. One of Jamie's eyes was swelling shut, and he was breathing heavily, but otherwise he didn't appear too badly off. I was in an agony of apprehension, lest one of the blows re-damage the wounded shoulder. My strapping job was still in place, but it wouldn't hold for long against this sort of treatment. How long was this going to go on? The room was silent, except for the smacking thud of flesh on flesh, and an occasional soft grunt. "We Angus'll stop when blood's drawn," whispered Mrs. Fitz, apparently divining my unasked question. "Usually when the nose is broken."
"That's barbarous!"
I hissed fiercely. Several people around us looked at me censoriously. The executioner apparently now decided that the punishment had gone on for the prescribed length of time. He drew back and let fly a massive blow. Jamie staggered and fell to his knees. The two guards hurried forward to pull him to his feet, and as he raised his head, I could see blood welling from his battered mouth. The crowd burst into a hum of relief, and the executioner stepped back, satisfied with the performance of his duty. One guard held Jamie's arm, supporting him as he shook his head to clear it. The girl had disappeared. Jamie raised his head and looked directly at the towering executioner. Amazingly, he smiled again, as best he could. The bleeding lips moved. "Thank you," he said, with some difficulty, and bowed formally to the bigger man before turning to go. The attention of the crowd shifted back to the Mackenzie and the next case before him. I saw Jamie leave the hall by the door in the opposite wall. Having more interest in him now than in the proceedings, I took my leave of Mrs. Fitzgibbons with a quick word and pushed my way across the hall to follow him. I found him in a small side courtyard, leaning against a wellhead and dabbing at his mouth with his shirt tail. "Here, use this," I said, offering him a kerchief from my pocket. "Mmm." He accepted it with a noise that I took for thanks. A pale, watery sun had come out by now, and I looked the young man over carefully by its light. A split lip and badly swollen eye seemed to be the chief injuries, though there were marks along the jaw and neck that would be black bruises soon.
"Is your mouth cut inside, too?"
"Uh-huh."
He bent down, and I pulled down his lower jaw, gently turning down the lip to examine the inside. There was a deep gash in the glistening cheek lining, and a couple of small punctures in the pinkness of the inner lip. Blood mixed with saliva welled up and overflowed.
"Water," he said, with some difficulty, blotting the bloody trickle that ran down his chin.
"Right."
Luckily, there was a bucket and horn cup on the rim of the well.
He rinsed his mouth and spat several times, then splashed water over the rest of his face.
"What did you do that for?"
I asked curiously.
"What?"
he said, straightening up and wiping his face on his sleeve. He felt the split lip gingerly, wincing slightly.
"Offer to take that girl's punishment for her. Do you know her?"
I felt a certain diffidence about asking, but I really wanted to know what lay behind that quixotic gesture.
"I ken who she is. Haven't spoken to her, though."
"Then why did you do it?"
He shrugged, a movement that also made him wince.
"It would have shamed the lass to be beaten in hall. Easier for me."
"Easier?"
I echoed incredulously, looking at his smashed face. He was probing his bruised ribs experimentally with his free hand, but looked up and gave me a one-sided grin.
"Aye, she's very young. She would have been shamed before everyone as knows her, and it would take a long time to get over it. I'm sore, but no really damaged. I'll get over it in a day or two."
"But why you?" I asked. He looked as though he thought this an odd question.
"Why not me?" he said.
"Why not?" I wanted to say. "Because you didn't know her. She was nothing to you. Because you were already hurt. Because it takes something rather special in the way of guts to stand up in front of a crowd and let someone hit you in the face, no matter what your motive."
"Well, a musket ball through the trapezius might be considered a good reason," I said dryly.
He looked amused, fingering the area in question.
"Trapezius, is it? I didn't know that."
"Oh, here you are, lad. I see you've found your healer already. Perhaps I won't be needed."
Mrs. Fitzgibbons waddled through the narrow entranceway to the courtyard, squeezing a bit. She held a tray with a few jars, a large bowl, and a clean linen towel.
"I haven't done anything but fetch some water," I said. "I think he's not badly hurt, but I'm not sure what we can do besides wash his face for him."
"Oh, no. There's always something that can be done," she said comfortably. "That eye now, lad. Let's have a look at that."
Jamie sat obligingly on the edge of the well, turning his face toward her. Pudgy fingers pressed gently on the purple swelling, leaving white depressions that faded quickly.
"Still bleeding under the skin. Leeches will help then."
She lifted the cover from the bowl, revealing several small, dark, slug-like objects, an inch or two long, covered with a disagreeable-looking liquid. Scooping out two of them, she pressed one to the flesh just under the brow bone, and the other just below the eye.
"See," she explained to me, "once a bruise is set, like, leeches do you no good. But where you hae a swelling like this, as is still coming up, that means the blood is flowing under the skin, and leeches can pull it out."
I watched, fascinated and disgusted.
"Doesn't that hurt?"
I asked Jamie. He shook his head, making the leeches bounce obscenely.
"No, feels a bit cold is all."
Mrs. Fitz was busy with her jars and bottles.
"Too many folk misuses leeches," she instructed me. "They're very helpful sometimes, but you must understand how. When you use them on an old bruise, they just take healthy blood, and it does the bruise no good. Also, you must be careful not to use too many at a time. They'll weaken someone as is very ill or has lost blood already."
I listened respectfully, absorbing all this information, though I sincerely hoped I would never be asked to make use of it.
"Now, lad, rinse your mouth with this. 'Twill cleanse the cuts and ease the pain." "Willow bark tea," she explained in an aside to me, "wi' a bit of ground orris root."
I nodded. I recalled vaguely, from a long-ago botany lecture, hearing that willow bark, in fact, contained salicylic acid, the active ingredient in aspirin. "Won't the willow bark increase the chance of bleeding?" I asked.
Mrs. Fitz nodded approvingly.
"Aye, it do sometimes. That's why you follow it wi' a good handful of St. John's wort soaked in vinegar. That stops bleeding, if it's gathered under a full moon and ground up well."
Jamie obediently swilled his mouth with the astringent solution, eyes watering at the sting of the aromatic vinegar. The leeches were fully engorged by now, swollen to four times their original size. The dark, wrinkled skins were now stretched and shiny. They looked like rounded, polished stones. One leech dropped suddenly off, bouncing to the ground at my feet. Mrs. Fitz scooped it up deftly, bending easily despite her bulk, and dropped it back in the bowl. Grasping the other leech delicately just behind the jaws, she pulled gently, making the head stretch.
"You don't want to pull too hard, lass," she said. "Sometimes they burst."
I shuddered involuntarily at the idea.
But if they're nearly full, sometimes they'll come off easy. If they don't, just leave them be, and they'll fall off by themselves."
The leech did, in fact, let go easily, leaving a trickle of blood where it had been attached. I blotted the tiny wound with a corner of a towel dipped in the vinegar solution. To my surprise, the leeches had worked. The swelling was substantially reduced, and the eye was at least partially open, though the lid was still puffy. Mrs. Fitz examined it critically and decided against the use of another leech.
"He'll be a sight tomorrow, lad, and no mistake," she said, shaking her head. "But at least you'll be able to see you to that eye. What you want now is a wee bit of raw meat on it and a drop of broth wi' ale in it for strengthening purposes. Come along to the kitchen in a bit, and I'll find some for you."
She scooped up her tray, pausing for a moment.
"What ye did was kindly meant, lad. Leah is my granddaughter, ye ken. I'll thank ye for her. Though she'd better thank ye herself if she's any manners at all."
She patted Jamie's cheek and padded heavily off. I examined him carefully. The archaic medical treatment had been surprisingly effective. The eye was still somewhat swollen, but only slightly discoloured, and the cut through the lip was now a clean, bloodless line, only slightly darker than the surrounding tissue. "How do you feel?" I asked.
"Fine."
I must have looked askance at this, because he smiled, still careful of his mouth.
"It's only bruises, you know. I'll have to thank ye again, it seems. This makes 3 times in 3 days you've doctored me. You'll be thinking I'm fair clumsy."
I touched a purple mark on his jaw. Not clumsy. A little reckless, perhaps. A flutter of movement at the courtyard entrance caught my eye. A flash of yellow and blue. The girl named Leah hung back shyly, seeing me.
"I think someone wants to speak with you alone," I said. "I'll leave you. The bandages on your shoulder can come off tomorrow, though. I'll find you then." "Aye. Thank you again."
He squeezed my hand lightly in farewell. I went out, looking curiously at the girl as I passed. She was even prettier close up, with soft blue eyes and rose-petal skin. She glowed as she looked at Jamie. I left the courtyard, wondering whether, in fact, his gallant gesture had been quite so altruistic as I supposed. Next morning, roused at daylight by the twittering of birds outside and people inside, I dressed and found my way through the draughty corridors to the hall. Restored to its normal identity as a refectory, enormous cauldrons of porridge were being dispensed, together with bannocks baked on the hearth and spread with molasses. The smell of steaming food was almost strong enough to lean against. I felt still off balance and confused, but a hot breakfast heartened me enough to explore a bit. Finding Mrs. Fitzgibbons up to her dimpled elbows in floured dough, I announced that I wanted to find Jamie in order to remove his bandages and inspect the healing of the gunshot wound. She summoned one of her tiny minions with a wave of a massive, white-smeared hand.
"Young Alec, do you run and find Jamie, the new horsebreaker. Tell him to come back with you to have his shoulder seen to. We shall be in the herb garden."
A sharp finger-snap sent the lad scampering out to locate my patient. Turning the kneading over to a maid, Mrs. Fitz rinsed her hands and turned to me.
"It will take a while yet before they're back. Would you careful look at the herb gardens? It would seem you've some knowledge of plants, and if you've a mind to, you might lend a hand there in your spare moments."
The herb garden, valuable repository of healing and flavours that it was cradled in an inner courtyard, large enough to allow for sun, but sheltered from spring winds with its own wellhead. Rosemary bushes bordered the garden to the west, chamomile to the south, and a row of amaranth marked the north border, with the castle wall itself forming the eastern edge, an additional shelter from the prevailing winds. I correctly identified the green spikes of late crocus and soft-leaved French sorrel springing out of the rich, dark earth. Mrs. Fitz pointed out foxglove, purslane, and betony, along with a few I didn't recognise. Late spring was planting time. The basket on Mrs. Fitz's arm carried a profusion of garlic cloves, the source of the summer's crop. The plump dame handed me the basket, along with a digging stick for planting. Apparently I had lazed about the castle long enough. Until Colum found some use for me, Mrs. Fitz could always find work for an idle hand. Here, my dear, do you set them here along the south side between the thyme and foxglove? She showed me how to divide the heads into individual buds without disturbing the tough casing, then how to plant them. It was simple enough. Just poke each clove into the ground, blunt end down, buried about an inch and a half below the surface. She got up, dusting her voluminous skirts. "Keep back a few heads," she advised me. "Divide 'em and plant the buds single, one here and one there, all round the garden. Garlic keeps the wee bugs away from the other plants. Onions and yarrow will do the same. And pinch the dead marigold heads, but keep them. They're useful." Numerous marigolds were scattered throughout the garden, bursting into golden flower. Just then the small lad she had sent in search of Jamie came up, out of breath from the run. He reported that the patient refused to leave his work. "He says," panted the boy, "as he doesn't hurt bad enough to need doctoring, but thank you for your concern." Mrs. Fitz shrugged at this not altogether reassuring message. "Well, if he won't come, he won't. You might go out to the paddock near noontide, though, lass, if you've a mind to. He may not stop to be doctored, but he'll stop for food if I ken young men. Young Alec here will come back for you at noontide and guide you to the paddock." Leaving me to plant the rest of the garlic, Mrs. Fitz sailed away like a galleon, young Alec bobbing in her wake. I worked contentedly through the morning, planting garlic, pinching back dead flower heads, digging out weeds and carrying on the gardener's never-ending battle against snails, slugs and similar pests. Here, though, the battle was waged bare-handed, with no assistance from chemical anti-pest compounds. I was so absorbed in my work that I didn't notice the reappearance of young Alec until he coughed politely to attract my attention. Not one to waste words, he waited barely long enough for me to rise and dust my skirt before vanishing through the courtyard gate. The paddock to which he led me was some way from the stables, in a grassy meadow. Three young horses frolicked gaily in the meadow nearby. Another, a clean-looking young bay mare, was tethered to the paddock fence, with a light blanket thrown across her back. Jamie was sidling cautiously up along one side of the mare, who was watching his approach with considerable suspicion. He placed his one free arm lightly on her back, talking softly, ready to pull back if the mare objected. She rolled her eyes and snorted, but didn't move. Moving slowly, he leaned across the blanket, still muttering to the mare, and very gradually rested his weight on her back. She reared slightly and shuffled, but he persisted, raising his voice just a trifle. Just then the mare turned her head and saw me and the boy approaching. Scenting some threat, she reared, whinnying, and swung to face us, crushing Jamie against the paddock fence. Snorting and bucking, she leapt and kicked against the restraining tether. Jamie rolled under the fence, out of the way of the flailing hooves. He rose painfully to his feet, swearing in Gaelic, and turned to see what had caused this setback to his work. When he saw who it was, his thunderous expression changed at once to one of courteous welcome, though I gathered our appearance was still not as opportune as might have been wished. The basket of lunch, thoughtfully provided by Mrs. Fitz, who did in fact know young men, did a good deal to restore his temper. "Ah, settle then, you blasted beastie," he remarked to the mare, still snorting and dancing on her tether. Dismissing young Alec with a friendly cuff, he retrieved the mare's fallen blanket, and shaking off the dust of the paddock, he gallantly spread it for me to sit on. I tactfully avoided any reference to the recent contretemps with the mare, instead pouring ale and offering chunks of bread and cheese. He ate with a single-minded concentration that reminded me of his absence from the dining hall the two nights before. "Slept through it," he said, when I asked him where he had been.
I went to sleep directly. I left you at the castle and didn't wait till dawn yesterday. I worked a bit yesterday after hall, then sat down in a bale of hay to rest a bit before dinner.
He laughed.
Woke up this morning still sitting there with your horse nibbling at my ear.
I thought the rest had done him good. The bruises from yesterday's beating were dark, but the skin around them had a good healthy colour, and certainly he had a good appetite. I watched him polish off the last of the meal, tidily dabbing stray crumbs from his shirt with a moistened fingertip and popping them into his mouth. "You've a healthy appetite," I said, laughing. "I think you'd eat grass if there was nothing else."
"I have," he said in all seriousness. "Doesn't it taste bad, but it's no very filling."
I was startled,
then thought he must be teasing me.
"When?"
I asked. "Winter, year before last. I was living rough, you know, in the woods with a group of lads raiding over the border. We'd had poor luck for a week and more, and no food among us left to speak of. We get a bit of porridge now and then from a crofter's cottage, but those folk are so poor themselves there's seldom anything to spare. They'll always find something to give a stranger, mind. But 20 strangers is a bit much, even for a Highlander's hospitality."
He grinned suddenly.
"Have you heard—" "Well, no, you wouldn't. I was going to say, had you heard the grace they say in the crofts?"
"No. How does it go?" He shook his hair out of his eyes and recited,
"Hurley, hurley, round the table, eat as muckle as you're able. Eat muckle, pooch nain, hurley, hurley, amen."
"Pooch nain?" I said, diverted. He patted the sporran on his belt.
"Put it in your belly, not your bag," he explained.
He reached out for one of the long-bladed grasses and pulled it smoothly from its sheath. He rolled it slowly between his palms, making the floppy grain heads fly out from the stem.
"It was a late winter then, and mild, which was lucky, or we'd not have lasted. We could usually snare a few rabbits, eat them raw sometimes if we couldn't risk a fire, and once in a while some venison. But there'd been no game for days, this time I'm talking of."
Square white teeth crunched down on the grass stem. I plucked a stem myself and nibbled the end. It was sweet and faintly acid, but there was only an inch or so of stem tender enough to eat. Hardly much nourishment there. Tossing the half-eaten stalk away, Jamie plucked another and went on with his story.
"There was a light snow a few days before, just a crust under the trees and mud everywhere else. I was looking for fungus, you know, the big orangey things that grow on the trees low down sometimes, and put my foot through a rind of snow into a patch of grass growing in an open spot between the trees. Reckon a little sun got in there sometimes. Usually the deer find those patches. They paw away the snow and eat the grass down to the roots. I hadn't found this one yet, and I thought, if they managed the winter that way, why not me? I was hungry enough I'd have boiled my boots and eaten them, did I not need them to walk in. So I ate the grass down to the roots, like the deer do."
"How long had you been without food?"
I asked, fascinated and appalled. 3 days with nothing, a week with not more than a drammach, a handful of oats and a little milk." "Aye," he said, reminiscently viewing the grass stalk in his hand. "Winter grass is tough, and it's sour. Not like this. But I didn't pay it much mind."
He grinned at me suddenly.
"I didn't pay much mind to the thought that a deer's got 4 stomachs either, while I had but one. Gave me terrible cramps, and I had wind for days. One of the older men told me later that if you're going to eat grass, you boil it first. I didn't know that at the time. Wouldn't have mattered. I was too hungry to wait."
He scrambled to his feet, leaning down to give me a hand up.
"Best get back to work. Thank you for the food, lass."
He handed me the basket and headed for the horse sheds, sun glinting on his hair as though on a trove of gold and copper coins. I made my way slowly back to the castle, thinking about men who lived in cold mud and ate grass. It didn't occur to me until I had reached the courtyard that I had forgotten all about his shoulder.
Chapter 7 Davy Beaton's Closet. To my surprise, one of Colum's kilted men-at-arms was waiting for me near the gate when I returned to the castle. Himself would be obliged, I was told, if I would wait upon him in his chambers. The long casements were open in the laird's private sanctum, and the wind swept through the branches of the captive trees with a rush and a murmur that gave the illusion of being outdoors. The laird himself was writing at his desk when I entered, but stopped at once and rose to greet me. After a few words of inquiry as to my health and well-being, he led me over to the cages against the wall, where we admired the tiny inhabitants as they chirped and hopped through the foliage, excited by the wind.
"Dougal and Mrs. Fitz both say as you've quite some skill as a healer," Colum remarked conversationally, extending a finger through the mesh of the cage. Well accustomed to this, apparently, a small grey bunting swooped down and made a neat landing, tiny claws gripping the finger and wings slightly spread to keep its balance. He stroked its head gently with a calloused forefinger of the other hand. I saw the thickened skin around the nail and wondered at it. It hardly seemed likely that he did much manual labour. I shrugged. It doesn't take that much skill to dress a superficial wound. He smiled.
Maybe not. But it takes a bit of skill to do it in the pitch-black dark by the side of a roadie. And Mrs. Fitz says you've mended one of her wee lad's fingers as was broken, and bound up a kitchen-maid's scalded arm this morning as well.
That's nothing very difficult either, I replied, wondering what he was getting at. He gestured to one of the attendants, who quickly fetched a small bowl from one of the drawers of the secretary. Removing the lid, Colum began scattering seed from it through the mesh of the cage. The tiny birds popped down from the branches like so many cricket balls bouncing on a pitch, and the bunting flew down to join its fellows on the ground.
"No connections to Clan Beaton, have you?" he asked.
I remembered Mrs. Fitzgibbons asking at our first meeting,
"Are you a charmer, then? A Beaton?"
"None. What have the Clan Beaton to do with medical treatment?" Colum eyed me in surprise.
"You've not heard of them? The healers of Clan Beaton are famous through the Highlands. Travelling healers, many of them. We had one here for a time, in fact."
"Had one? What happened to him?" I asked.
"He died," Colum responded matter-of-factly. "Caught a fever, and it carried him off within a week. We've not had a healer since, save Mrs. Fitz."
"She seems very competent," I said, thinking of her efficient treatment of the young man Jamie's injuries. Thinking of that made me think of what had caused them, and I felt a wave of resentment toward Colum. Resentment and caution as well. This man, I reminded myself, was law, jury, and judge to the people in his domain, and clearly accustomed to having things his own way. He nodded, still intent on the birds. He scattered the rest of the seed, favouring a late-coming grey-blue warbler with the last handful.
"Oh, aye, she's quite a hand with such matters. But she's more than enough to take care of already, running the whole castle and everyone in it. Including me," he said, with a sudden charming grin. "I was wondering," he said, taking swift advantage of my answering smile, "seeing as how you've not a great deal to occupy your time at present, you might think of having a look at the things Davy Beaton left behind him. You might know the uses of a few of his medicines and such."
"Well, I suppose so. Why not?" In fact, I was becoming slightly bored with the round between garden, stillroom, and kitchen. I was curious to see what the late Mr. Beaton had considered useful in the way of paraphernalia.
"Angus or I could show the lady down, sir," the attendant suggested respectfully.
"Don't trouble yourself, John," Colum said, gesturing the man politely away. "I'll show Mistress Beecham myself."
His progress down the stair was slow and obviously painful. Just as obviously, he didn't wish for help,
and I offered none. The surgery of the late Beaton proved to be in a remote corner of the castle, tucked out of sight behind the kitchens. It was in close proximity to nothing save the graveyard, in which its late proprietor now rested. In the outer wall of the castle, the narrow, dark room boasted only one of the tiny slit windows set high in the wall, so that a flat plane of sunlight knifed through the air, separating the darkness of the high, vaulted ceiling from the deeper gloom of the floor below. Peering past Colum into the dim recesses of the room, I made out a tall cabinet, equipped with dozens of tiny drawers, each with a label in curlicue script. Jars, boxes, and vials of all shapes and sizes were neatly stacked on the shelves above a counter where the late Beaton evidently had been in the habit of mixing medicines, judging from the residue of stains and a crusted mortar that rested there. Colum went ahead of me into the room. Shimmering motes, disturbed by his entry, swirled upward into the bar of sunlight like dust raised from the breaking of a tomb. He stood for a moment, letting his eyes grow used to the dimness, then walked forward slowly, looking from side to side. I thought perhaps it was the first time he had ever been in this room. Watching his halting progress as he traversed the narrow room, I said, "You know, massage can help a bit. With the pain, I mean." I caught a flash from the grey eyes and wished for a moment that I hadn't spoken. But the spark disappeared almost at once, replaced by his usual expression of courteous attention. "It needs to be done forcefully," I said, "at the base of the spine especially."
"I know," he said. "Angus Moore does it for me at night."
He paused, fingering one of the vials.
"It would seem you do know a bit about healing, then."
"A bit." I was cautious, hoping he didn't mean to test me by asking what the assorted medicaments were used for. The label on the vial he was holding said Perlis Ovis. Anyone's guess what that was? Luckily, he put the vial back and drew a finger gingerly through the dust on a large chest near the wall.
"Been some time since anyone's been here," he said. "I'll have Mrs. Fitz send some of her wee lassies along to clean up a bit, shall I?"
I opened a cupboard door and coughed at the resulting cloud of dust.
"Perhaps you'd better," I agreed.
There was a book on the lower shelf of the cupboard, a fat volume bound in blue leather. Lifting it, I discovered a smaller book beneath this one, bound cheaply in black cloth, much worn along the edges. This second book proved to be Beaton's daily logbook, in which he had tidily recorded the names of his patients, details of their ailments, and the course of treatment prescribed. A methodical man, I thought with approval. One entry read, 2nd of February, A.D. 1741. Sarah Graham Mackenzie, injury to thumb by reason of catching the appendage on edge of spinning wheel. Application of boiled pennyroyal, followed by poultice of, one part each yarrow, St. John's wort, ground slaters and mouse ear, mixed in a base of fine clay. Slaters? Mouse ear? Some of the herbs on the shelves, no doubt. "Did Sarah Mackenzie's thumb heal well?" I asked Colum, shutting the book.
"Sarah?" "Ah," he said thoughtfully. "No, I believe not."
"Really? I wonder what happened," I said. "Perhaps I could take a look at it later." He shook his head, and I thought I caught a glimpse of grim amusement showing in the lines of his full, curved lips. "Why not?" I asked. "Has she left the castle, then?"
"You might see so," he answered.
The amusement was now apparent.
"She's dead."
I stared at him as he picked his way across the dusty stone floor toward the doorway.
"It's to be hoped you'll do somewhat better as a healer than the late Davy Beaton, Mrs. Beecham," he said.
He turned and paused at the door, regarding me sardonically. The sunbeam held him as though in a spotlight.
"You could hardly do worse," he said,
and vanished into the dark. I wandered up and down the narrow little room, looking at everything. Likely most of it was rubbish, but there might be a few useful things to be salvaged. I pulled out one of the tiny drawers in the apothecary's chest, letting loose a gust of camphor. Well, that was useful, right enough.
I pushed the drawer in again and rubbed my dusty fingers on my skirt. Perhaps I should wait until Mrs. Fitz's merry maids had had a chance to clean the place before I continued my investigations. I peered out into the corridor. Deserted. No noises either. But I wasn't naive enough to assume that no one was nearby. Whether by order or by tact, they were fairly subtle about it, but I knew that I was being watched. When I went to the garden, someone went with me. When I climbed the stair to my room, I would see someone casually glance up from the foot to see which way I turned. And as we had ridden in, I hadn't failed to note the armed guards sheltering under the overhang from the rain. No, I definitely wasn't going to be allowed simply to walk out of here, let alone be provided with transport and means to leave. I sighed. At least I was alone for the moment, and solitude was something I very much wanted, at least for a little. I had tried repeatedly to think about everything that had happened to me since I stepped through the standing stone. But things moved so rapidly around this place that I had hardly had a moment to myself when I wasn't asleep. Apparently, I had one now, though. I pulled the dusty chest away from the wall and sat down, leaning back against the stones. They were very solid. I reached back and rested my palms against them, thinking about the stone circle, trying to recall every tiny detail of what had happened. The screaming stones were the last thing I could truly say I remembered. And even that I had doubts about. The screaming had kept up all the time. It was possible, I thought, that the noise came not from the stones themselves, but from whatever I'd stepped into. Were the stones a door of some kind? And into what did they open? There simply were no words for whatever it was. A crack through time, I supposed, because clearly I had been then, and I was now, and the stones were the only connection. And the sounds. They had been overwhelming, but looking back from a short distance, I thought they were very similar to the sounds of battle. The field hospital at which I was stationed had been shelled 3 times. Even knowing that the flimsy walls of our temporary structures wouldn't protect us, still doctors, nurses and orderlies had all dashed inside at the first alarm, huddling together for courage. Courage is in very short supply when there are mortar shells screaming overhead and bombs going off next door. And the kind of terror I had felt then was the closest thing to what I had felt in the stone. I now realized that I did recall some things about the actual trip through the stone. Very minor things. I remembered a sensation of physical struggle, as though I were caught in a current of some kind. Yes, I had deliberately fought against it, whatever it was. There were images in the current, too, I thought. Not pictures, exactly. More like incomplete thoughts. Some were terrifying, and I had fought away from them as I... well, as I passed. Had I fought toward others? I had some consciousness of fighting toward a surface of some kind. Had I actually chosen to come to this particular time because it offered some sort of haven from that whirling maelstrom? I shook my head. I could find no answers by thinking about it. Nothing was clear, except the fact that I would have to go back to the standing stones. "Mistress?" A soft Scottish voice from the doorway made me look up. 2 girls, perhaps 16 or 17, hung back shyly in the corridor. They were roughly dressed, with clogs on their feet and homespun scarves covering their hair. The one who had spoken carried a brush and several folded cloths, while her companion held a steaming pail. Mrs. Fitz's lassies, here to clean the surgery.
"We'll no be disturbing you, mistress,"
one asked anxiously. "No, no," I assured them. "I was about to leave anyway."
"You've missed the noon meal," the other informed me, "but Mrs. Fitz said to tell you as there's food for you in the kitchens whenever you like to go there."
I glanced out of the window at the end of the corridor. The sun was, in fact, a little past the zenith, and I became conscious of increasing hunger pangs.
I smiled at the girls.
I might just do that.
Thank you. I brought lunch to the fields again, fearing that Jamie might get nothing to eat until dinner otherwise. Seated on the grass, watching him eat, I asked him why he'd been living in the rough, raiding cattle and thieving over the border. I had seen enough by now, both of the folk that came and went from the nearby village and of the castle dwellers, to be able to tell that Jamie was both higher born and much better educated than most. It seemed likely that he came from a fairly wealthy family, judging from the brief description he had given me of their farm estate. Why was he so far from home?
"I'm an outlaw," he said, as though surprised that I didn't know. "The English have a price of 10 pounds sterling on my head." "Not quite so much as a highwayman," he said deprecatingly, "but a bit more than a pickpocket."
"Just for obstruction," I said unbelievingly.
10 pounds sterling here was half the yearly income of a small farm.
I couldn't imagine a single escaped prisoner was worth that much to the English government.
"Och, no. Murder."
I choked on a mouthful of bread and pickle. Jamie pounded me helpfully on the back until I could speak again. Eyes watering, I asked, "Who did you kill?" He shrugged.
"Well, it's a bit odd. I didn't actually kill the man whose murder I'm outlawed for. Mind you, I've done for a few other redcoats along the way, so I suppose it's not unjust."
He paused and shifted his shoulders, as though rubbing against some invisible wall. I had noticed him do it before, on my first morning in the castle, when I had doctored him and seen the marks on his back.
"It was at Fort William. I could hardly move for a day or two after I'd been flogged the second time, and then I had fever from the wounds. Once I could stand again, though, some friends made shift to get me out of the camp, by means I'd best not go into. Anyhow, there was some ruckus as we left, and an English sergeant-major was shot. By coincidence, it was the man that gave me the first flogging. I'd not have shot him, though. I'd nothing personal against him, and I was too weak to do more than hang on to the horse in any case."
The wide mouth tightened and thinned.
"Though had it been Captain Randall, I expect I'd have made the effort."
He eased his shoulders again, stretching the rough linen shirt taut across his back, and shrugged.
"There it is, though. That's one reason I do not go far from the castle alone. This far into the Highlands there's little chance of running into an English patrol, but they do come over the border quite often. And then there's the watch, though they'll not come near the castle either. Colum's not much need of their services, having his own men to hand."
He smiled, running a hand through his bright cropped hair till it stood on end like porcupine quills.
"I'm no precisely inconspicuous, you ken. I doubt there's informers in the castle itself, but there might be a few here and there about the countryside as would be glad enough to earn a few pence by letting the English know where I was, did they know I was a wanted man."
He smiled at me.
"He'll have gathered the name's not MacTavish."
"Does the laird know?"
"That I'm an outlaw? Oh, aye, Colum knows. Most people through this part of the Highlands likely know that. What happened at Fort William caused quite a bit of stir at the time, and news travels fast here. What they won't know is that Jamie MacTavish is the man that's wanted, provided nobody that knows me by my own name sees me."
His hair was still sticking up absurdly. I had a sudden impulse to smooth it for him, but resisted. "Why do you wear your hair cropped?" I asked suddenly, then blushed. "I'm sorry. It's none of my business. I only wondered, since most of the other men I've seen here wear it long." He flattened the spiky licks, looking a bit self-conscious.
"I used to wear mine long as well. It's short now because the monks had to shave the back of my head, and it's had but a few months to grow again."
He bent forward at the waist, inviting me to inspect the back of his head.
"See there, across the back."
I could certainly feel it, and see it as well when I spread the thick hair aside. a 6-inch wheel of freshly healed scar tissue, still pink and slightly raised. I pressed gently along its length. Cleanly healed and a nice neat job by whoever had stitched it. A wound like that must have gaped and bled considerably. "Do you have headaches?" I asked professionally. He sat up, smoothing the hair down over the wound. He nodded.
"Sometimes, though none so bad as it was. I was blind for a month or so after it happened, and my head ached like fury all the time. The headache started to go away when my sight came back."
He blinked several times, as though testing his vision.
"Feeds a bit sometimes," he explained, "if I'm very tired. Things get blurry round the edges." "It's a wonder it didn't kill you," I said. "You must have a good thick skull on you." "That I have. Solid bone, according to my sister."
We both laughed. "How did it happen?" I asked. He frowned, and a look of uncertainty came over his face.
"Well, that's just the question," he answered slowly. "I didn't remember anything about it. I was down near Carriarrick Pass with a few lads from Loch Lagan. Last I knew, I was pushing my way uphill through a wee thicket. I remember pricking my hand on a holly bush and thinking the blood drops looked just like the berries. And the next thing I remember is waking in France, in the abbey of Santa Anne de Beaupré, with my head throbbing like a drum, and someone I couldn't see giving me something cool to drink."
He rubbed the back of his head as though it ached yet.
"Sometimes I think I remember little bits of things. A lamp over my head, swinging back and forth. A sort of sweet, oily taste on my lips. People saying things to me. But I don't know if any of it's real. I know the monks gave me opium, and I dreamed nearly all the time."
He pressed his fingers flat over closed eyelids.
"There was one dream I had over and over. Tree roots growing inside my head, big gnarled things growing and swelling, pushing out through my eyes, thrusting down my throat to choke me. It went on and on with the roots twisting and curling and getting bigger all the time. Finally, they'd get big enough to burst my skull, and I'd wake, hearing the sound of the bones popping apart."
He grimaced,
sort of a juicy cracking noise like gunshots underwater. "Oh."
A shadow fell suddenly over us, and a stout boot shot out and nudged Jamie in the ribs.
"Idle young bastard," the newcomer said without heat, "stuffing yourself while the horses run wild. And when's that filly going to be broke, eh, lad?" "None the sooner for my starving myself, Alec," Jamie replied. "Meanwhile, have a bit. There's plenty."
He reached a chunk of cheese up to a hand knotted with arthritis. The fingers, permanently curled in half grip, slowly closed on the cheese as their owner sank down on the grass. With unexpectedly courtly manners, Jamie introduced the visitor, Alec McMahon Mackenzie, Master of Horse of Castle Leoch. A squat figure in leather breeks and rough shirt, the Master of Horse had an air of authority sufficient, I thought, to quell the most recalcitrant stallion.
"An eye like Mars to threaten or command,"
the quotation sprang at once to mind. A single eye it was, the other being covered with a black cloth patch. As if to make up for the loss, his eyebrows sprouted profusely from a central point, sporting long grey hairs like insects' antennae that waved threateningly from the basic brown tufts. After an initial nod of acknowledgement, old Alec, for so Jamie referred to him, no doubt to distinguish him from the young Alec who had been my guide, ignored me, dividing his attention instead between the food and the three young horses switching their tails in the meadow below. I rather lost interest during a long discussion involving the parentage of several no doubt distinguished horses not among those present, details of breeding records of the entire stable for several years, and a number of incomprehensible points of equine conformation, dealing with hocks, withers, shoulders, and other items of anatomy. Since the only points I noticed on a horse were nose, tail, and ears, a the subtleties were lost on me. I leaned back on my elbows and basked in the warming spring sun. There was a curious peace in this day, a sense of things working quietly in their proper courses, nothing